This week on Potlatch, Tim Wallace, president of Doy Unlimited, the Ammonic Dancers, and the proposal to lower heating costs in the bush. Rex Moore. In a recent interview, Tim Wallace told me how he became president of the Doyon Corporation.
Well, basically, I became involved in the Native Land Claim Settlement and the lobby effort for it back in 1968, and became president of the Fairbanks Native Association, and as a result, got involved on the board of directors for the Alaska Federation of Natives. And, of course, after the passage of the Act, the people that basically took leadership positions within the regional corporations were those that were involved in the lobby effort because of their knowledge of the land claim settlement, its intent. And in the early stages, it was basically a implementation of the Act and certain things that you had to comply with, certain timetables. And as a result, I was elected to the initial board of directors, to the incorporators, which incorporated Doyon, and sat on the board of directors since. And then when John Sackett resigned, there was a election for presidents in which I withdrew from the race for the state legislature in order to seek the position of president of the corporation, and the president of the corporation is elected by the board of directors. And that was a process.
And how do you try to keep the subsistence needs reconciled with the needs of making a profit?
Well, of course, Doyon's position is that the subsistence issue, of course, is a number one priority with us. We still have a lot of people that still rely on subsistence for their livelihood. And basically, we have entered into various exploration agreements for oil and gas and for minerals. This is to help us locate them and to, once they're located, to look at the feasibility. And the process, basically, that we have in mind is one of conferring with the villages that are nearby in order that we do not disturb the various trapping, hunting, and fishing areas that they're accustomed to. It's a really fine-tuned question, and the solution is also very intricate because on one hand, you do have the obligation to other stockholders, other than those people residing around the villages, to make a profit if it's there. But I think with the subsistence issue in mind, that everybody has a, meaning our stockholders, has a relationship to subsistence and know its needs, and its and as a result, they're more sympathetic to preserving that. And it goes back into, again, your heritage, your culture, and to some degree, a preservation of that type of living. And so I would imagine that perhaps sometime in the future that subsistence versus development will crop up within Doyon, and it'll basically be a individual agreement, agreement per agreement on basis, one-on-one, and each circumstance will be different, and but it is something that we have thought about, and it is really a difficult question to answer, and you would have to really be faced with that and look at all these situations. Right now, all we can do is generalize.
You haven't had any serious problems yet with that?
No, we haven't.
What are some of the development plans that Doyon has been involved in recently and plans to be involved in the future?
Well, of course, we've entered into an oil and gas exploration agreement with the Louisiana Land and Exploration headquarters out of New Orleans to look at some land in the Kandik area. They're basically in their second well now, and they have the obligation to drill two additional wells. We do have a minerals exploration agreement with a consortium of groups basically made up of Ethel Corporation, Union Carbide, McIntyre Mines, General Crude, and BP. And the operators for that is an outfit called WGM, which coordinates and does all the communications between the groups and us and whatnot. And so right now we're basically looking for prospects and those areas which have potential for development. And once we establish that it is a good prospect, then we'll go into the feasibility, into the subsistence issue, all the impacts involved, environmental, and to see whether we can extract it and make a profit.
What about hard rock minerals? Are you doing any, and do you have any plans for digging for hard rock minerals?
Of course, the consortium group that I mentioned, that was of the five companies, are involved in the mineral exploration, whereas LLME is in the oil and gas exploration.
What are some of the minerals that you may find or you expect to find on Doyon lands?
Well, just some of them are asbestos, uranium, coal, lead, zinc, molybdenum, and of course some of the side benefits, and some of those are gold.
How can you explain briefly now to somebody who doesn't understand corporate management very well the kind of relationship a native regional corporation has with these other companies?
Of course, without getting involved in the various details of the contracts, which are confidential, I'll just briefly hit it, where in the agreements that we have a asset which we call land. And on that land, there's some potential for whatever a company may be looking for. As a result, you enter into an agreement where they supply the necessary capital and equipment, etc., to search for those commodities. And we, in turn, for supplying the land and the potential, of course, each agreement is different. So this doesn't hold true for every agreement, but in some cases you would get a front-end bonus, royalty agreements, In some cases, you would get the right to participate down the road when it looks feasible. In some cases, you would have to, of course, put in some capital of your own, depending on the agreement. So it's a number of ways in which you work various agreements, depending on, first of all, who you're dealing with and the expectancy of finding whatever they're looking for.
One of the merchants in downtown Fairbanks a few months ago made a comment that, talking about Native corporations in general, and possibly Doyon in particular, he complained about the number of drunks on Second Avenue, said that a number of these drunks were Natives. He didn't say, he made sure he said that were not all Natives are drunks, and not all drunks are Natives. But why can't the Native corporations take care, with all the money they have, take care of these drunks and keep them off Second Avenue in Fairbanks? Is there a response you have to that?
Well, of course, we do have a responsibility to stockholders. And at some point in time, you do have to draw a line as to how far your responsibilities to stockholders go. Of course, in any profit corporation, your main objective is to make a profit. And then there are certain responsibilities that you do have in running a corporation, and there are also certain liabilities that come along with those responsibilities. And if the corporation gets involved in a social service type program or areas in which there is no return on the dollar, other stockholders could file a stockholder suit saying you're negligent in your operation of the corporation, particularly at this stage in the game when we're still in gearing up process and investment process, waiting for a return on the dollar. And so there is a period there in which your company is going to not have the excess capital in which to issue dividends or issue charitable contributions. Both the state and federal government have some responsibility in this area of alcoholism, and we do not want to set a precedent in trying to assume that responsibility from the state or federal government, because they are watching the regional corporations as if they were in a glass cage, so to speak. And if there is a hint that we would move into that area, there's a good possibility that they would cut back on funds. And so it's a broad question and a broad answer, but that's about as specific as I could get.
Thank you. We've been talking to Tim Wallace, president of Doyon. Now the Ammonic Dancers. The next dance is about a man with a sled going for driftwood. The man is pushing the sled full of wood, and he recognizes that he's getting to be an old man, and his neck starts bothering him, then his legs. He's really getting old, not like when he was young. This is done by, I believe, Tommy Moses and Willie Moore. Two men dancing, one sitting, one kneeling. Three women standing in back of them in their very colorful cuss-box. The man with the sled going for driftwood. Thank you. This has been a program of Eskimo Dances by the Imanuk Dancers. The first of a two-part series. Be sure to listen for the announcement of the second of this series. Our thanks to the dancers of Imanuk for this fine entertainment.
Unata umioknaji programmer bigaji. Janik Nizukufji Igaranarachputwani, KUAC, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska.
An instructor at the University of Alaska's Tanana Valley Community College, Doeth Dallas, presented recently a proposal to the state of Alaska for disposing of its royalty gas.
Under our suggested changes that we would make in the contracts that the state of Alaska has already presented to the legislature for their approval to sell the gas to three gas pipeline transmission companies in the lower 48, we would simply like to see the gas, the state exclude from those contracts all of the wet products, the liquid products from the gas, and such portion of the methane that we could use, let's say, in the Fairbanks area. And under that proposal then, all of these liquid products would be available for a separate sale to industry in this area rather than be shipped on to the south to be processed somewhere down there.
An associate of Mr. Dallas, Bob Dempsey, comments on what this may mean to people in the rural areas of Alaska.
One of the most immediate effects of this would be that it would make available for the first time to the bush communities in Alaska a moderate price source of fuel and energy for their conveniences and development of any kind of industries or the increase in job and employments that might be available to them.
What kinds of jobs?
Well, most all types of work, as you know, revolve around energy. So the cost and in doing new things in the bush or in the villages, even in Nome, for example, has to be predicated on the cost of energy. If someone to open a new store or a new industry of any kind, one of the prime concerns has to be the cost of energy and what it's going to cost to run these businesses. So with the advent of moderate price fuel, a whole spectrum of maybe even unplanned projects at this point in time now become realistic for the first time.
Could we break this down a little bit now? For example, what kinds of opportunities will, say, somebody in Caltag have? He wants to heat his house. How is your plan going to reduce his costs specifically?
Well, he may be heating his house in two ways now. He's having fuel oil flown in, or he is even now having propane flown in. The cost of propane is extremely high in the interior of Alaska because there are transportation charges involved, either coming from the Kenai Peninsula or, in fact, propane coming from Canada. You would immediately cut the price of propane in about half. Now, this is the figure that the local private enterprise people are dealing in propane now have indicated to us would be a realistic figure if there were, in fact, a local source of propane available.
Now, this savings is achieved simply because you don't have to take it from as far away. You can take it from Fairbanks as opposed to
the
lower 48.
Right, from the lower 48 or from the Kenai, yes.
And what about the price of the product itself? For example, if one were to use other kinds of gas to heat as opposed to oil. Does one save on that too?
Well, yes, if you would do it in an urban area. Of course, you couldn't move the methane product, which is what we normally think of as what runs through a pipeline into someone's house, and they heat it. In the bush areas, in the rural communities, you'd have to take that product, which is transportable, which would be the propane product, and then they're now using it. It's not uncommon, and they're not used to it. But the average price of propane in the Fairbanks area right now is about 80 cents per gallon. If you could reduce that immediately by half, that's 40 cents right off the top. And the transportation charges, again, would then only be from Fairbanks to wherever they might need it. So it would be initially an appreciable savings.
But the transportation of these products will still be the same. They'd still have to transport them by plane.
That's correct. That's correct. Until some other way is accessible. But propane, you must realize, propane is of the LPGs. That is the most transportable and the easiest one to handle. So as a source would become available, new developments within Fairbanks, new transportation methods and things of this nature would become available. So you could look for a savings.
Now, such a plant, as you've indicated, would help the people of Fairbanks, obviously, by providing employment. Could the same be true? Could some of the bush areas also develop plants to produce these materials with Alaska's share of the royalty gas?
I guess it would be theoretically possible. One would have to be cautious that by locating a plant in the bush, you didn't work contrary to the economics that you have now looked at by having the fuel available in Fairbanks. I think what development in the bush would be in other related industries or other industries that they might be contemplating that, however, do need energy now. Construction, for one thing. For example, construction projects, you have to look at the cost of energy. If you had available a moderate price cost of energy, more construction projects might be undertaken. So there's a new development and a new source of revenue and employment.
Is it possible that one of the native corporations could be involved in such a plant, even if it were located in an urban area?
Not even possible. I'm sure it would be desirable.
Bob Dempsey in Dulles, Dallas, with a plan to lower fuel costs in the bush. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.